It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
I'll tell you, Farm to Table Talk ends up talking about journeys more than anything else, I believe. Talking about journeys of people along the trail of producing food, how it's produced, on its way to the table. And along that way, we end up finding that there are curious consumers and chefs and people that are in government affairs that are all curious about these journeys. Well, today I'm sitting in a red barn, in an office on top of a red barn, at the end of a dirt road that had a sign at the beginning of it that said, Journey's End. So it's appropriate I'm talking about somebody that has put that sign up and has been on quite a journey. He's been on a journey that's covered producing something that a lot of people don't know how to farm, and also working in organizations and pursuing dreams. Rich Collins. Rich, welcome to Farm to Table Talk.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I want to start at the end and then work to the beginning. To get to your place, and we're sitting here in a comfortable office on the second floor of a red barn, and it's called Journey's End, as I pulled down the trail. Why do you call where we are and where you're doing all your work right now, Journey's End?
Well, because after almost 40 years of farming, this is the first farm that my wife and I owned that we can call our own. It's where I'm going to stop at some point, and I don't want to go any farther than this. And the Journey's End name I actually borrowed from a farm that I used to pass by in the suburbs of Carmichael as a kid on my bike. It was a little 2-acre farm with a sign that said Journey's End. It always captured my imagination. So when we finally found this place, we decided to name it Journey's End because this is the end of the road for me.
But I want to go back to being a kid riding a bike around Carmichael. So how old were you when you were noticing that sign that said Journey's End?
I was 10. I grew up in Sacramento. Our back fence was, in fact, aligned with Carmichael. And when I was 10, my father purchased 2 acres in Carmichael on Kenneth Avenue. And that's where I really started and my agricultural journey, if you will, with about a 1-acre market garden, poultry, bees, equipment, fruit trees, blackberries, all that kind of good stuff.
On 2 acres in an area that was a pretty well-populated area?
Fairly well-populated, but there was still that rural element, that undeveloped rural element to Carmichael at that point. These were kind of the old vestiges of ranch headquarters and farms that had not yet been developed.
Well, that was kind of prior to Farm to Table, at least the term Farm to Table. And it was prior to a lot of farmers' markets. So what happened with the food produced on a 2-acre farm in a metropolitan area over 30 years ago?
Great question. And this is almost 50 years ago. But we had a farm stand, literally a little table in front of our property that we opened up on the weekends. And then my brother and I also did door-to-door deliveries with our little trailer on a bicycle in our neighborhood, where we would go out and spread flyers around the neighborhood and see if we could solicit some business, and sold it that way directly to households, as well as the little stand on Kenneth Avenue.
Oh, now this is just almost too cool to imagine. So these kids, you're pulling things around on a wagon, you're selling it even door to door, the fruits and vegetables. And now, even then, I mean, you were real ahead of time, because there's people now that I talk to on Farm to Table Talk that dream of doing the exact same thing now, 50 years later, of on a few acres, producing fruits and vegetables and selling them. Now they're selling them at farmers markets or direct to chefs.
Yeah, we were just doing what we wanted to do. I mean, we didn't call it anything, or we just, those are the only avenues. You know, we did send a little bit, I don't know if we sold, we may have sold to a restaurant or two. We did put classified advertisements in the Sacramento Bee, which back in the day before Craigslist, that was the way you did it. And we would take orders that way. So it was the best, you know, we used the tools we had at our disposal back in the early 70s.
Now, did your dad have an off-the-farm job too?
Yeah, he was a real estate broker, residential real estate broker in Carmichael.
So as you grew up then, and you decided to, and you went to college then.
Went to UC Davis.
What'd you major in?
My major was agricultural and managerial economics.
Okay. So while you were studying that, again, bridging the gap between being a kid that was pulling this wagon around and now you're in college, what were you hoping was coming, was going to be the journey next? I mean, when you got yourself committed to be in agriculture, did you think you were going to be a farmer? Did you think you were going to get somehow in the food business? What moved you then?
I always wanted to be a farmer. Since I was probably 4 or 5, despite growing up in the suburbs and being the first generation out of San Francisco. So there was no farming background in our family. I'm fifth generation Californian and first generation California farmer. For whatever reason, I always wanted to be a farmer.
So when you were at UC Davis and you were studying agriculture at that time, were you beginning to get an idea that how you might be able to, after that education, farm?
Yeah, absolutely. Because before I arrived at UC Davis as a senior in high school in May of 78, I was actually washing dishes at a French restaurant in Sacramento called Restaurant La Salle. The owner had grown up on a farm in Illinois. He was married to a French woman. And he, one evening, brought me in on a Monday night when the restaurant was normally closed to wash dishes for a VIP birthday banquet. On the menu was braised Belgian endive. And knowing that I wanted to be a farmer and not coming from a farm family, as he was braising the endive and I was over washing dishes, he said to me, "You know, this is what you ought to grow." And I turned around and I said, "Well, what is it?" And he says, "It's Belgian endive. I paid $4 a pound for it." And I said, "Really?" And that was the literally the sowing of the seed for that idea in my mind to pursue and as an avenue of entry into agriculture.
You know, people think they know what endive is, but describe it, because it's not something that you find on your plate every day.
True. That was the case then, and it's still the case now to a large extent. Endive is a second growth of a chicory root. The first growth is from seed to produce that chicory root, same root used in New Orleans-style coffee when dried, roasted, and ground up. It takes about 5 months to produce the root from seed in the field, sown in the spring, harvested in the fall. The root is then brought into cold storage for some minimum period to vernalize the root, and then that root is grown again in the dark. And that's the method to produce a blanched head of endive, which is essentially the second growth of that chicory root, the first growth having taken place in the field from seed.
I would know a chicory if I saw it. But an endive, what it ends up on your plate, again, people are trying to get this picture. Describe what it looks like.
It's a small, like white little missile shaped head of leaves. So generally those leaves are cut off at the base. So you'll see this relatively long, you know, 4 to 5 inch long leaf, inch wide, but blanched. It's a yellow white color because it grows in that complete absence of light.
So you're in what, a barn that is dark? You have to go in there and work. So
yeah, it's a mushroom type facility.
Okay.
You know, dark, humid, mild temperatures, that's environmentally controlled, and that's where the endive itself grows from the chicory root.
Does it go on usually on a salad?
Correct. The primary means of consumption here in this country is either as an appetizer. The leaf is the carrier or boat for a whatever that you could put on there, you know, marinated shrimp or crab salad or things like that, or as a salad. And then ultimately the best way, like I just was exposed to back in May of 78, is a cooked version, whether it be braised, grilled, or baked. So it's very, very versatile in that sense. It can be the center of the plate. A classic Flemish dish is called endive au jambon, which is endive wrapped in ham, baked in a bechamel sauce.
Oh, all right. Slow down on that one. I want to imagine that sounded great.
Oh, it's wonderful. But it could also be a braised vegetable, or it can be the salad of a dinner. So in that sense, it's really, really versatile.
Coming back to UC Davis, you got out of school. How did you saw your first exposure to this and your experience in the restaurant and so forth, the endive? So what happened between your being in college and actually becoming an endive farmer?
Well, I tried and tried to grow it in 79. I tried planting 2 acres and failed miserably. Then I did a little bit of research in 1980, 81 at UC Davis. There was virtually no information available, practically no information available on how to grow it, because this is before the web. So I did a lot of, you know, searches for information at the libraries at Davis. It wasn't a big topic to be had. So I ended up leaving school for the entire year, calendar year of 1982. And I headed to Europe to work on Andy farms throughout France, Belgium, and Holland.
And you just went over there, and did you speak French?
I did not speak French. I had a little background in French, two quarters at UC Davis. And so that was enough to get me by. I was able to learn French, you know, and farm French, if you will, once arriving in Europe.
Farm French is different than French?
Yeah, I can carry on a pretty good conversation in northern France, but you'd get me into Paris, I might get lost.
Oh, well, I tell you, that sounds exciting right there and quite an adventure. There's not very many people that just pull up roots and say, I'm going to go learn about this particular food and go where they grow it and learn from them. Then I've got a lot of questions on kind of being in that situation in France, but let's skip back to the States. When you come home, how did you apply that?
Well, I got home in November of 82, and then finished up two quarters at Davis. So I finished up in June of 83, my degree there. And then in June of 83, started farming in Vacaville on 5 acres that we planted 5 acres of chicory roots.
To grow endive.
Correct.
And that was in Vacaville, is near San Francisco. And you found 5 acres to be able to. And when you need 5 acres, was it most of that under roof to be?
No, that was 5 acres in the field.
Oh, and the chicory. Okay.
Yeah, 5 acres of chicory.
Okay.
That was with Ton Lum, was a UC Davis graduate and a large farmer down between Dixon and Vacaville. And he was my mentor. He farmed probably 5,000 acres at the time. And of course I farmed 5. He was very, very, very accommodating to help out and, you know, get me started with the basics.
Ultimately, you kept on that and became the primary endive grower in America?
You can apply any adjective to us with regards to American production because we were the only producers in America.
So if anybody ate endive that was American endive, they were coming from, you were growing it.
Yes.
Wow, that's something.
For the most part. There were a few perhaps smaller growers that popped up every now and then, but they didn't last.
Well, in that case, marketing might be a whole lot different than it is for other products, because it sounds to me, if you're the only game in town, if you knew about endive, they would have to come. They'd almost come find you. Were they kind of beating your door down to buy the product?
Oh, I don't think anybody ever beat the door down to find endive. We, to the contrary, we had to go beat doors down to gain entry. There were a few folks who sought us out, but, you know, it's a relatively unknown product. It's relatively bitter because it's a chicory. It's a different color. It's not... necessarily pronounced the correct way. Many people say endive versus endive. They're two.
I should have spelled it earlier. ENDIVE.
Yeah, but there are two chicories that go by that spelling. But one is endive, one is endive. And then it's relatively expensive because of the process involved, and people don't know what to do with it. So we had quite a few challenges, not just in the field.
Well, now if you're selling wine, like a lot of people in that area do, you get to pull in and bring in a few bottles and say, here, taste this wine. So when you were introducing endive, were you taking the product in to chefs and say, you know, try our endive, and having to give them some ideas of how they possibly could use it?
We gave away thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds throughout all of the years of producing endive, but especially early on. Yeah, we did a lot of sampling because, you know, a lot of chefs especially didn't really know what it was or weren't familiar with it. If they were, they thought it had to come from Europe because that's where it, you know, mm-hmm. started historically. Mm-hmm. So it was always an imported product for them, and they were a little bit befuddled that it could be grown in America. And therefore, we gave a lot away, not only trying to crack into that existing market, but of course make that market bigger.
You know, it's interesting. I could go on and on about trying to understand how that happened. And now I can think back and thinking I've seen endive and have had it on menus before. And the journey that that it took to get there just reminds me we need to get back to talking about your own journey. Because after years of doing this and having really being responsible for the endives that are grown in America from this 5-acre beginning, and we could even argue your 2-acre beginning when you're a 10-year-old in Carmichael. But after that, you decided to leave it and switch gears. What's been that transition that you decided, okay, been there, done that. I've had all these years of working in endives, and now my journey is going to take a different direction.
Yeah, after 38 years in the endive business, my wife and I had an opportunity to sell our shares to an existing partner. We took that opportunity because 38 years was enough. 38 years is basically a career. Luckily, I started early, so I still have some time to do some more things. So we're now here at Journey's End, which is a 195-acre conservation easement-protected farm that we live on here on Highway 80 between Davis and Dixon. So a dream has come true in that sense, that we own our own farm, and we're now working here as individual sole proprietors of this business on a farm that we own. So it is a dream come true.
Explain what a conservation easement farm is.
The ground we own is protected in perpetuity for agriculture via a conservation easement, which is held in trust with the Solano Land Trust.
So somebody at one time had this farm and was a regular farm that wasn't protected. And then they sold the rights to
a land trust.
Okay. And that means that all it can ever be done is for production agriculture now?
Correct. It cannot be subdivided. It can only be used for agriculture. And that is in perpetuity. So there's also an open space element to the easement as well. So we can only build on certain small footprints of the property. Mm-hmm. So it's preserved in that sense, and it's basically done to prevent Davis and Dixon from melding together over time into one larger development cities.
Well, we've had a guest before that's talked about how much farmland we're losing, like every minute that we're losing farmland, and a lot of times it is to developments. Mm-hmm. And so when you had to come up with the money to buy this place, at least you weren't competing with someone developing suburbs.
Yeah, we would never, ever, ever, ever have been able to afford it because we bought it basically for its ag value.
So what are you going to grow here?
We are currently producing a hybrid asparagus seed that I have. I'm a contract grower for two brothers on the East Coast who I've known for about 25 years. So we have an enterprise here that we do producing that hybrid seed. There's about 6 varieties that we're producing. We have 4 small farmers on the property as well, producing fruits and vegetables and livestock. And then we rent out the balance of the property to a large grower in the neighborhood who's doing, you know, the agronomic crops.
Doing what?
Agronomic crops like tomatoes, sunflowers.
Oh, okay.
Beans, things like that.
Now, the farmers that are renting from you that are on the property too, are they able to make a living from a few acres?
Yeah, they're giving it a go. They're starting very small, but they're, you know, kind of like we were back in the 1970s. They're exploring those different marketing avenues, which are a little more broader in scale now, whether it be CSAs or the direct to sale, restaurant sales, farmers markets, of course. We have a little fruit stand on the highway, so there's lots of different avenues now, and they're making it happen.
Well, you know, Rich, this gets to another aspect of how your journey has gone, and we may still argue yet about how far this is close to the end or not of the journey, because it sounds like you're still developing so many things. One of them is you've worked with other farmers. You've worked in organizations where young farmers and small farmers were trying to get started, trying to get their feet on the ground. One organization that you've been involved with is the Community Alliance of Family Farmers. What is that?
Well, CAF has been around for 40 years now. It started back in the late 70s, and it has historically been an advocate for smaller family farms, trying to create environments in which those farms can thrive, but also create better, more resilient outcomes for not only the farms, but the communities in which they operate, as well as the environment in which they're growing.
Well, how is the challenge to those smaller scale farms different from large scale agriculture? I mean, we have across the country, not just here in California, we have a lot of large scale agriculture, and many use the term industrialization to describe, you know, the scale and the approach to the farming. They have issues as well. Give us another example maybe of how the scale and the situation facing small community or family farms might be for the larger scale, which are sometimes family farms too, but they might be incorporated.
And a lot of those entities, regardless of their scale, face very common sets of challenges with regards to weather and disease and insect pressures and production challenges, you know, just the basic biology. The smaller farms probably have a little bit more of a challenge with market access, mm-hmm. and economies of scale or lack thereof. There's also a technology gap. There's a lot of big, efficient technology for larger farms that require scale, mm-hmm. to be able to afford them and adapt them into the operation. So there's that little bit of back to the future, if you will, with regards to smaller scale agriculture, but that's not going to be based on human toil or very, very rudimentary practices. Mm-hmm. So there's some unique challenges to smaller farmers, and you could also say appropriate research and technology, that market access, finance, labor, you know, being able to keep somebody busy for the year versus say very, very peak seasonal needs, those types of things. Some of those are still common to larger scale farms too. But, you know, California historically has been a place of larger scale farms, and it's been that juggernaut has been going on for several decades.
Is there a problem with small farms around large farms? I mean, when they're all like cheek to jowl together. So is there any particular challenge if you happen to have a really large scale farm as your neighbor and you're trying to work things out as a 5 or 10 acre specialty crop producer?
I don't, it might even be a benefit, quite frankly, because that larger farm, like when I started with Ton Lum farming 5,000 acres, I farmed 5. But he was able to come in and help me sometimes with some of his equipment. Didn't take him very long because the equipment was pretty doggone big even back then. But on my 5 acres, I still needed some ground ripped or some beds pulled and things like that. So there's perhaps even a little bit of synergy with scaling farms, small and large, and placing them near each other so that there's some cooperative efforts that can take place.
So the Community Alliance of Family Farms, you do educational programs, social programs, you know, communications, and even legislative issues you get involved with, right?
We have a very strong policy program up at the Capitol, primarily in Sacramento, a little bit of outreach into Washington, but not very much. That's with other statewide organizations throughout the country. Yeah, we have a real strong presence and history of policy work with the folks up in the Capitol.
So if something that affects agriculture, food, and farming has an interest to you, you may show up in a committee hearing room. And the other organizations are there too, I would imagine. In some states, it's Farmers Union or NFO, but it's Farm Bureau, it's Western Growers. Lots of different people that you just kind of take a number and make sure you get a chance to speak your piece. So when the legislators are considering something that affects food and farming, they're getting this broad perspective, including the large general farm organizations and organizations like yours.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it. Oftentimes, CAF over time has taken a somewhat contrarian position on many issues. I believe I'm stating this correctly. We were the only statewide ag organization that supported SGMA, Sustainable Groundwater Management Act. Even though many of those other groups wrote it, they ultimately opposed it. And, groundwater is a pretty doggone precious resource that we really need to focus on and manage better in the future. And we will. We're quite proud of that.
So do you ever run into cases, though, when you're in there and the chairman of the committee to just say, wish you all you farmers go in the other room and figure out what's best for everybody and come back and tell us when you're in agreement?
That would be nice, but you know, it's a diverse group with regards to age and geography and what they produce, how they produce it. Politically, it's a relatively conservative group, but not everybody. That might not ever happen.
Yeah.
But yeah. It is nice to have a voice at the Capitol, regardless of scale or the size of your organization.
Now, there's other organizations, and one of them is called Farm Guilds or Farmer Guilds. Your organization is coming together with them somehow.
Yeah, we merged. CAF merged with the Farmers Guild back in January of 2017. So we are now CAF/Farmers Guild. The Farmers Guild is about a five-year-old organization of basically guilds or chapters around the state of younger farmers gathering together for technical reasons, you know, sharing information, but also social reasons and also some policy reasons, in their locales, you know, countywide, if you will. They didn't have a statewide policy presence, and that was of interest to them to merge with CAF because of our policy presence. And it made sense. We need chapters. We need members. And so the CAF Farmers Guild merger took place 18, 20 months ago to great effect. It's just those folks in the ag realm that are perhaps out on the edges a little bit, on the margins, doing things a little differently or a little smaller scale production or niche markets that have perhaps some different and more special, unique needs than the larger scale ag organizations might be able to provide them day in and day out.
People that are farming or want to get into farming, how do they find these organizations? How do they find organizations like the Guild? In this case now, you're rebranding yourself with the Alliance and the Guild combined. How do they find you in the first place?
Well, the web. I'm not a social media person. I imagine it's just an unbelievable tool for gaining access. I heard a chef once describe the web as the death of distance. And, you know, in 1978, when I started with Ondi, even when CAF started, you know, it was word of mouth. It was a newsletter. It was a mailing list. Mm-hmm. It was an advertisement in a ag, you know, publication or a newspaper or something posted on a bulletin board in the hallways of UC Davis. Mm-hmm. And now we have this unbelievably quick, efficient way to communicate and spread information.
And I'm curious too, how would you describe the diversity in your organization? Because I know that there's a lot said about in agriculture itself. The average farmer in America is, I believe, 62 years old now. They just keep getting older. And there's going to have to be a change. There has to be more people of color, women that are leading instead of just the men that have traditionally been seen as the primary farmers. What do you see as far as the diversity in the people that are getting involved in the Guild and CAF?
There's definitely a younger element, and that younger element is more diverse with regards to both race and gender. Three out of the five young farmers on our property here are female. There's probably still a preponderance of Caucasians in the industry, but there is a growing interest, and as our population diversifies, there is a growing interest with more folks of color, whether it be Latinos or African Americans or Asians. There's a lot of more diversity coming up on the rungs down towards the bottom.
Well, and I know some people in other industries, when they're getting started, they feel it's a little awkward breaking into whatever that industry group and so forth. And I would imagine that people like seeing folks like themselves that are young or have not been as involved before feel welcome, that the other people that you're around are in similar situations oftentimes.
Yeah, we need good folks in agriculture, regardless of their ethnic background or their gender. It's so important to have a new layer down there of folks coming up into that professional realm to take over the production of our food, and it's going to happen.
And these smaller scale farmers are different people that are becoming the farmers of tomorrow. Are they necessarily organic?
I would say many of them have an organic bent to them. I don't know the statistics, but I would say the vast majority are organic, or they want to be as organic as possible. There's even this beyond organic movement. You know, organic is now a legal term, basically. So some folks are opting to not certify organically, but still farm that way, or to strive to farm that way.
So Rich, if somebody comes to you and they say, okay, Rich, you're claiming you're at the end of your journey. I'm just at the beginning of my journey and I'm doing something else, but I really wish I could farm. Where do I start?
Oh, that's a great question. And it's not an easy answer. I'd say start small. I would say grow something that you at least like, if not love. I would be really keen on starting with the market and working backwards. Just because you can grow it doesn't mean you can sell it. And, you know, you can generally only eat so much of what you grow. You got to sell some of it. And I would be patient. I wouldn't be in a hurry. You know, this is not the type of work where you necessarily hit a home run your first time at the plate. You might. And I oftentimes tell young folks, you know, everybody wants to exclaim their passion for doing this and thinking that passion means this, you know, just boundless exuberance or all this energy or drive. But the word passion means to suffer. And when you do this and you do it with passion, you're going to suffer just inevitably because of employees, because of buyers, because of weather, because of insects, because of mistakes. You have to wait a year to rectify. It is a great venue for suffering. So you better have passion.
You know, and you've been on the other side of this too, in that you had some farmers come to you and say, I want to be able to farm on some of your land. They had to find out who you were, come and knock on the door and suggest to you that that how this business arrangement might work, I assume, mm-hmm. that they can have 2 to 5 acres of your farm and then work their tail off. So you were saying that I think 3 of them are ladies. And so they had to approach you and pitch the idea, and you had to decide whether you could work together and make whatever the business arrangement is and get them started. It must be interesting to be on that side of it too.
It is. And, you know, like I've mentioned a couple of times that Ton Lum did mm-hmm. the same thing for me and my wife back in the early 80s. And so we just felt it was important to, you know, play it forward and try to reciprocate and do the same for young folks who, you know, are giving it a go. And it was tough then and it's tough now.
Well, what inspires you when you talk to people that say they have a dream and that there's this stage? Is there some reason that you have for being optimistic or sharing optimism with them on how this can work out?
Yeah, I would say it stems from two things. People got to eat. They always will. And also, it's incredibly gratifying to produce food that people will give you money for, and then they put it in their mouth. And that's just a great, you know, act of faith, it's just very gratifying to be able to produce food. You know, you're using sunlight, water, soil, seeds, very elemental inputs, plus your gumption and labor and energy to render something is so important to us and has, you know, environmental impacts. It has health impacts. It has community impacts. It's very gratifying to do. It's probably one of the tougher ways to make a living, I would say, but it's an incredibly gratifying way.
A lot of people refer to the farm to fork or farm to table as a movement. Is it a movement?
My sense is it should be a way of life, But I think Americans generally approach food a little differently. And I understand that. I mean, there's a lot of convenience out there. There's a lot of processed stuff. But most of the world doesn't consider it a movement. It's how they live. And maybe, again, we're going back to the future and rediscovering what we should never have forgotten.
You know, the first time I met you, you gave me a couple books to go home and read. And what struck me, and I'm not through the books yet, but kind of things what struck me was it is a way of life. Somehow, in the last 40, 50 years of agriculture, feeling that they had to farm fence row to fence row and have, you know, huge equipment and thousands of acres and all of this thing, it was something that they kept putting down and saying, no, it's not a way of life, it's a business. And it seems like we went through a stage of decades of almost being ashamed of the fact that we referred to it as a way of life, as if the business was a higher calling and was somehow contradictory to a way of life. And when I hear you talk about these things, and when I hear us talking about a movement, it's like, hey, go ahead. You know, you can come out now and admit to the fact it is a way of life. It's one that you hope can make you a good living, but it is a way of living.
Absolutely. And it's a great way to make a living because it can be so gratifying and rewarding. What I was referring to, it should be the way we live. I was also referring to consumers.
Yeah.
That consumers should, I believe, should have a better relationship with their food. You know, it doesn't mean you have to grow everything or you know exactly where it came from and who's the person that grew it and the variety name and things like that. But just have a better working knowledge of how food is produced, the implications of the decisions you make and purchasing it, and the demand signals that you can send as a consumer to various aspects of ag. We need lots of different parts of agriculture, you know, different scale and different methodologies. But I would say there is a need to just focus better on the elements of ag production with regards to soil, water, plant health, nutrient density of foods. There's a movement coming that's going to facilitate that.
Well, and it's helped along too that there are so many places anymore that you can go order something, and the restaurant itself is able to tell you a story about their farmers.
Yep.
And stores. I mean, the major supermarket chains now, when you go to those chains, they have little signs up in the produce area and some other areas that are providing a story, not assuming that every consumer cares, not everyone is paying attention, but some do, and more are. And it's just interesting that sharing the story, sharing these journeys, if you will, is something that's ingrained in the system these days.
Yeah, I've seen my name in supermarkets around the country. Not a lot, but every now and then, that either my name or the name of the Andive company would pop up when Andive was there. And that's pretty gratifying to see.
Well, it's reassuring, too. If you're buying a product where somebody puts their name on it and it goes all the way back to the farm, that makes you feel better about feeding your family, I think, if you know something about it. And I think you're right, too. It's done well with large scale and small scale. All of them have a story. And thank you for sharing your story. We could call it Journey's End or Story's End, but I want to thank you for sharing this with us on Farm to Table Talk.
Well, thanks for having me, Roger. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.